and the third spot. To me, it all seemed so innocent, just a fun new project, a way to share our lives with the world. But as Ruby practiced her opening lines to an imaginary audience, I wonder if perhaps she felt a familiar flutter in her stomach, the same nervous energy that had accompanied each of her pregnancies. After all, she was, in a sense, giving birth again, this time to a new version of herself and a new chapter in our family story. In many ways, family vlogging is a very LDS-aligned pursuit, a natural extension of our traditional practices. Vlogging offers a modern form of bearing testimony and keeping personal and family records while simultaneously engaging in passive missionary work. Vlogs mean church members can share their faith, values, and daily lives with a global audience, potentially attracting interest in the church and its teachings. In a way, the synergy between YouTube and LDS families seemed almost predestined, fitting perfectly with the church's desire to be in the world but not of the world, allowing members to engage with modern culture while maintaining our distinct values and beliefs. Perhaps that's why Utah and the broader LDS community have become such powerhouses in the realms of family vlogging and traditional lifestyle content creation. Some of the earliest and most successful family vlogging channels have come from our communities, documenting life with multiple children, showcasing the appeal of family life to a mainstream audience, while demonstrating how modern media can be harnessed to share testimonies and values in a relatable, engaging way. Who knew that in the age of viral scandals and cancel culture, it would be the wholesome, family-centered content of LDS vloggers that would capture the world's attention? And who could have foreseen that my own family would come to embody both, the wholesome ideal and the scandalous, becoming a cautionary tale of what happens when the line between authenticity and performance becomes blurred beyond recognition? Chapter 9. Baby Climbs Out of Crib. I actually don't remember the exact moment when the cameras first started rolling. All I know is that one day, we were just a regular family, going about our lives. The next, there was a janky camera constantly pointed in our direction, documenting our every move for the consumption of strangers on the internet. Ruby posted her first video on January 8, 2015, with my youngest sister in the starring role. It began with footage from her gender reveal party in 2013. In our kitchen, the five of us children and Ruby are filmed by Kevin as we gather around a cake on the kitchen counter, Ruby's pregnancy bump clearly visible. Kevin asks a question from behind the camera. "So, what are we doing today?" he asks. "Cutting a cake, and inside is the color of the baby," Chad exclaims, excited. His disappointment is palpable as Ruby slices into the cake, revealing a pink sponge interior. The scene shifts to the hospital, where Ruby cradles our newborn sister, her sixth and youngest child, a tiny pink bow perched atop her nearly bald head. We kids fuss and coo over our new sibling, our faces alight with wonder. My youngest brother is shown cradling the tiny infant in his arms. "Give her a kiss," Ruby gently coaxes. He leans in, placing a soft kiss on her forehead. "Say I love you," Ruby encourages. "I love you," he whispers. The video then cuts to my youngest sister, now a toddler, sprawled on the kitchen table, eyeing me and my banana with unmistakable interest. She rises, her steps wobbly but determined, and takes a hearty bite when offered the fruit. Ruby's novice editing skills become apparent in the next shot, featuring our beloved yellow lab, Nolly. Charming footage, except it was upside down. And that was that. Ruby's entry into the world of family vlogging. Nothing Oscar-winning by any means. 2 weeks later, Ruby dropped her second video, tasting sushi for the first time. Picture this. Ruby, out with Kevin's academic buddies, bravely facing down her first plate of sushi. Spoiler alert, she's not a fan. The end. A few days later, video number 3, meet the 8 passengers, Chad. Introducing my 10-year-old blonde, blue-eyed prankster of a brother. It was cute, and people liked it, and so on. My mom kept making videos starring us and posting them to 8 passengers. Little did we know, this bizarre ritual would come to dominate our lives for the next 7.5 years. We never chose to be internet celebrities, but that made no difference. Soon, our lives now revolved around nonstop content creation, whether we liked it or not. Birthdays, barbecues, even lazy Sunday afternoons. No moment was too mundane to escape documentation. Ruby, her sisters, and her brother Beau, who had also jumped aboard the vlogging bandwagon, were now constantly filming us for their respective vlogs. You couldn't sneeze without it being immortalized from multiple angles. My mother and her sisters seemed to operate on some unspoken biological synchronicity and had an uncanny tendency to get pregnant around the same time, as if their bodies were attuned to some shared familial rhythm. Except for me and Chad, who had no cousins the same age, the cousins on my mother's side grouped neatly into age brackets, creating miniature cohorts that mirrored each other in age and development, growing up in tandem, perfect for the aunts to share their milestones and experiences on YouTube. It was a content creator's dream. But for me, a 12-year-old girl, this constant surveillance was excruciating. All I wanted was to grow up in peace, deal with my bodily changes and those pesky new zits without it being recorded. But my mother was omnipresent, her phone an extension of her arm, directing us like a Hollywood producer. "Do this, do that, Sherry, we're filming. Smile, Sherry, say good morning." I was beginning to feel like a sideshow freak. Step right up and witness Sherry, the amazingly awkward adolescent, in all her cringeworthy glory. The worst part? The internet ate it up. Everyone seemed to love what Ruby was posting, which, of course, encouraged her to post more. She approached YouTube with the dedication of a startup CEO, putting in long hours day after day. She had done her homework and knew that in the wild west of social media, consistency is king. You have to post regularly, which meant every little moment was mined for content. First steps, lost teeth, epic tantrums, you name it, Ruby filmed it, laser-focused on building her subscriber base, knowing blogging was a numbers game, and Ruby had always been good with numbers. She knew the main way vloggers make money is through YouTube's AdSense program, but you have to hit a 1,000-subscriber milestone and rack up 4,000 hours of watch time in the last year in order to qualify. Once you've checked those boxes, you start making money every time someone watches or clicks on an ad in your videos. Ruby became hyper-focused on getting those first 1,000 subscribers. It was her golden ticket to the big leagues. "I interrupt our regular schedule to make an announcement," Ruby said on July 9th, 2015, filming a special announcement video. "We have hit over 1,000 subscribers. I'm so excited, especially considering that last month we only had 142. It had taken her about 6 months to hit the magic number. Not long after, the gravity of how much this YouTube thing was going to turn our lives upside down finally sank in. I was sitting at the kitchen table, feeding my youngest sister applesauce, when Ruby burst into the kitchen, her face flushed with excitement. "Sherry, you won't believe this," Ruby announced. "Our little lady is a bona fide internet sensation." She scooped my 2-year-old sister out of her high chair and twirled her around. "What do you mean, Mom?" "I mean, that video of her climbing out of her crib? It's gone viral, 50,000 views and counting." "Wow, that's a lot of people." I didn't get it. My sister in her nursery had climbed out of her crib for the first time. What was so interesting about that? Ruby laughed, planting a kiss on my sister's chubby cheek. "Isn't it amazing, our little family touching so many lives?" As I watched her practically dance out of the room, I felt a sinking sensation in my gut. Our lives were already starting to feel like a reality show. Did going viral mean we were about to go primetime? As the weeks turned into months, that crib video continued its astonishing ascent, racking up views by the millions. 10 million, 20 million. By year's end, an unfathomable 50 million strangers had glimpsed into our lives. Meanwhile, our subscriber count was climbing steadily. By September, we had reached 5,000 subscribers, then 100,000 by April, 400,000 come August. Unfathomable reach from Louisiana to Laos, Kentucky to Kenya. It was surreal. Watching the subscriber numbers tick upward, I could barely believe each one represented a real person out there in the world who had chosen to watch videos like Spiders, Slugs, and Snails, Oh My, and Dutch Braid Your Own Hair. Not to mention the horror movie that was Sherry's piano recital. The first, but certainly not the last time, Ruby would take one of my most awkward moments and turn it into the story of the week. As the numbers climbed, a nagging thought kept creeping into my mind. Surely at some point people would get bored of this? Surely one day this would all end and our lives could go back to normal. Little did I know then that normal was a luxury we had already left far behind. Chapter 10. Remodeling Reality. As our YouTube channel evolved, so did our home. Ruby invested heavily in remodeling, every change designed to please the camera's eye. Goodbye, ugly yellow walls. Hello, stark white and bored batten. Sterile, but oh so photogenic. Ruby meticulously curated the porch, adding stylish patio furniture, plump pillows, and atmospheric lanterns. We even removed the house numbers to avoid the hassle of having to blur them in videos. The result was a picturesque facade, perfect for the camera, but perhaps a bit too perfect for real life. a visible symbol of our transition from an ordinary family to YouTube stars. For me, every video shoot remained a special kind of torture. I could never get used to it or relax. It was like one of those recurring nightmares where you're suddenly naked on a stage with a sea of eyes staring back at you, mocking. I mean, puberty is brutal enough, let alone with an audience. Thankfully, I found a silver lining in this heinous new situation. Leverage. I figured out that if I wanted something from Ruby, a later bedtime, a new outfit, or permission to hang out with friends, my best bet was to ask her while the camera was rolling. It was a you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours kind of deal. Ruby wanted me as her happy, smiling co-star. It was going to cost her. A trip to the mall, a get-out-of-chores-free card, a shiny new gadget, whatever I needed at the time. Ruby tried to make the whole surreal enterprise seem fun, even beneficial to us. If you film your ice cream outing, you can pay for it with the 8 passengers' credit card, she'd say. Just think, free food and a tax write-off. What teen wouldn't want to flash a credit card to feel grown up and important? I became fluent in the language of tax loopholes before I could even drive. Outfit hauls, trips to the mall, I learned it could all be written off as business expenses. If I filmed in the car on our way to the amusement park, even the gas could be written off as a business expense. It did start to feel like we'd hacked the system. Why wouldn't everyone want to make a living by turning their kids into content, by commodifying every moment from cradle to college? Our first brand deal was with a slow cooker company. They sent us one of their fancy pots and a bunch of meals to cook in it. After that, the floodgates opened. Our house became a revolving door of brand deals and swag. Clothes, tech, snacks, you name it, we reviewed it. Some days there were so many gifts that we couldn't open them all. Boxes would sit for days in the hallway, unopened. We got to go on lots of all-expenses-paid vacations, always with the omnipresent camera. One of our first was to Seattle on a brand deal for a game company. We stayed in an Airbnb on the Puget Sound, which was particularly special because it was where Kevin had attended grad school, and the whole family went, including Ruby's parents. It was crazy how different our lives had become. We used to make our own granola, spending hours canning fruit and clipping coupons and buying everything in bulk to save money. Now we had more stuff than we knew what to do with. We'd gone from being a family that was proud of making do with less to one that had too much and more on the way. I thought about Dad, who had always been the intellectual powerhouse of our family, dedicating his brilliant mind to understanding earthquakes and making the world a safer place. Yet, it was Mom's newfound obsession with the internet that was finally bringing us true financial success. Point, shoot, upload, and watch the money roll in. On October 15th, 2015, Pregnancy and Infant Loss Remembrance Day, Ruby sat alone on her bed, facing her camera, about to film a video that was a little different from the ones she'd done before. A story she hadn't talked about in years. Her miscarriage in 2009. Her voice cracked as she described the sterile doctor's room, the cold gel on her stomach, and then the deafening silence where there should have been the rhythmic heartbeat of her baby boy. Ruby's pain was palpable as she described the moment she realized her baby was dead and his little body would have to be taken out of her. The confusion she felt, waking up in Kevin's car, feeling utterly empty, both physically and emotionally, without ever being able to see her baby's body before it was disposed of. Nothing for her to take home, no ashes, nothing to hold on to. Her anger about her lack of agency and the way things were handled still simmered, and by the end she was weeping, years of buried frustration spilling over. "Anyway, I don't know if this video is going to be helpful to any of you," she said, wiping her tears. "Gosh, this has been really helpful for me." The video didn't go viral, but it was powerful, and I still have complicated feelings about it. I'm glad Ruby felt able to share her story in such a raw and vulnerable way. In the realm of family vlogging, it so happens that rawness and vulnerability are the lifeblood that keeps subscribers engaged and channels thriving. But the line between authenticity and exploitation becomes dangerously blurred when children are involved. My unborn baby brother in heaven would suffer no ill effects from Ruby sharing his story. But what about the rest of us, whose stories were being shared daily? What are the lasting repercussions of growing up on camera without any say in the matter? How does that constant exposure shape a child's sense of self, their future relationships, their very understanding of privacy? And what does consent really look like when you're a child, too afraid to say no? Personally, I mourn those precious formative years spent in service to someone else's vision. Ruby might claim her kids were always on board, but the truth is, we never really had a choice in the matter. And what about Ruby? What might be the emotional repercussions of her snowballing online success? Yes, Ruby's drive was bringing in money for her family and validation for her ego, but none of those superficial rewards could fix what was broken inside her. Instead, they seemed to fuel a vicious cycle, pushing her to seek more validation, more views, more content, often at the expense of her family. The most problematic element in our family dynamic, Ruby's relentless ambition, fueled by a potent mixture of unresolved pain and narcissism, had become the driving force of our existence. It was as if we had taken the most poisonous plant in our garden and instead of uprooting it, made it the centerpiece of our lives. Chapter 11. Teenage Influencer. Toward the end of 8th grade, when I was 14, I started my own YouTube channel for one reason. Money. I saw what YouTube had done for Ruby. If this could pay for college and save me from working at the grocery store after school, I was all in. Although I'd have to get Ruby's permission first, of course. Ruby's eyebrow arched. Your own channel? Better be serious about it. I promise I will. You're not old enough for an AdSense account, so I'll have to manage your earnings. Oh, okay, I said, disappointed. I'd forgotten I wouldn't be legally allowed to have my own AdSense account until I was 18. Don't worry, if your channel is successful, we'll let the earnings build up, she continued. A little nest egg for the future. All you need to do is give me a shout out on 8 Passengers to get me started, and I'll get a ton of subscribers that way, I said, excited. Ruby laughed. No way, Sherry. No shortcuts, no shout outs. You need to get to 100,000 subscribers on your own, just like I did, and then I'll give you a shout out on 8 Passengers. Seriously? I have to earn a shout out from my own mom? Sherry, I don't shout out anyone with less than 100,000, you know that. Consider it an incentive for you to treat it like a real business. I'll shout you out once you've built a channel worth promoting. Challenge accepted, Mom. But make no mistake, I hated every second of filming. I'm done, I'd shout with relief after each video, the camera finally off. It was torture, but it was a job. Then came the editing, writing the captions, figuring out when to post, and uploading. Anyone who says posting online isn't real work clearly hasn't done it themselves. I posted twice a week, and like my mom, I exploited my own siblings, doing shaving videos with my sisters and talking about periods, because I knew it would get views. The guilt eats at me now, but back then, I was just following the blueprint Ruby had laid out. This is what people like. This is what makes money. The personal stuff. One day, Ruby brought her laptop into my room, wanting to show me something. Look at this, she said excited, in case you've ever wondered why YouTube is the most important thing that ever happened to this family. On her screen, a direct message from an 8 Passenger subscriber, a woman who said she had grown up in a troubled home. Her parents fought constantly, and she often felt lost and alone, until she stumbled upon 8 Passengers. Watching your family, it's like I finally found a place where I belong, Ruby read out loud. You guys are so happy and loving and, above all, honest. It gives me hope that maybe one day I can have that too. I've even started going to church because of you, and I'm thinking about getting baptized in the LDS church. Thank you for showing me the light. Ruby's face glowed as she closed the laptop. Isn't that amazing, Sherry? God gave us this platform, and now look at the difference we're making in people's lives, showing them the way. When viewers praised her for her honesty, for showing the unvarnished truth of family life, I saw the pride in her eyes. It made her even more sure that she was doing something noble, something meaningful. But reading the comments, I had a different take. My parents are divorced and they fight a lot. When I watch your videos, I feel like I'm part of your family. I feel like I've grown up with you guys. You're like my siblings. I know everything about you. These comments always left me with an uneasy feeling. To me, it felt like a weird attachment, people latching onto families that weren't their own, while inflating Ruby's ego to mythic proportions. Wow, thank you for showing the tough side of parenting. I wish my parents had been like you, Ruby. Maybe then I wouldn't have gotten into so much trouble as a teenager. As much as our fans might have appreciated the story Ruby was selling, they had no idea what they were doing. Enabling her, fueling her sense of righteousness and power as a mother who could do no wrong, and cheerleading her as she drifted further and further away from reality. One day, 13-year-old me walked into the cafeteria at my junior high, clutching my lunch tray as I navigated the sea of cliques and social circles. I headed toward the corner table where I typically huddled with fellow bookworms, but before I got there, a high-pitched voice cut through the din. Hey, Sherry, over here! I turned, startled, to find one of the cheerleaders waving at me from the coveted populars table. She sat surrounded by her posse, a sea of perfectly coiffed hair and designer labels. She had never spoken to me before, let alone summoned me from the depths of Nerdville and invited me to sit with her. But things had shifted. Now that I was internet famous, I'd become so interesting in their eyes. I knew their sudden interest was as fake as their meticulously curated social media feeds. They weren't interested in me, Sherry the person, but in Sherry the internet celebrity, a potential boost to their own online presence. Still, it felt nice to be noticed and included for once, even if it was just for shallow reasons. So I sat with the popular girls, smiled for the inevitable selfies, laughed at inside jokes I didn't quite understand, and pretended this was all perfectly normal. Suddenly, Jake, a boy I'd secretly been crushing on for months, approached our table. My heart skipped a beat as he flashed his signature grin. "How's it going, influencer?" he said, his eyes twinkling with interest. Great, I managed, my smile a mixture of genuine excitement and practiced poise. "Cool. Hey, are you on Snapchat?" "Nah," I shrugged, trying to sound nonchalant. Jake's eyebrows shot up in surprise. "You're like the biggest thing on YouTube, but you don't snap?" "Yeah, I know it's weird," I said, embarrassed. "My mom won't let me." "That sucks. My mom's a piece of work, too. Hey, maybe we should hang out and talk about our mothers." "Ugh, no thanks," I said, before realizing what I was saying and rapidly correcting. "I mean, yes, we should hang out and do that." He flashed another smile before walking away. I watched him leave, frozen in a mix of elation and disbelief. The other girls at the table were equally stunned. Whether Jake's interest stemmed from my YouTube fame was irrelevant in that moment. All I could think about were his eyes, the way they had looked at me with genuine curiosity and warmth. He was the first boy who had ever shown me any attention. Of course, there was one little problem, a tiny snag in my grand romantic plans. I wasn't allowed to hang out with boys until I was 16. On top of that, Jake wasn't very active in the LDS church, which I knew would be a problem as far as my parents were concerned. Plus, his parents were divorced, and his dad had tattoos. More deal breakers. But with Jake's smile still stuck in my head, none of that mattered. For the first time in my life, I was going to rebel. After school, heart pounding, I swapped numbers with Jake, my hands trembling slightly as I typed my phone number into his cell. It felt dangerous and exciting all at once. From then on, we texted constantly. I was always checking my phone when no one was looking. Each message gave me a thrill I'd never felt before. I downloaded Snapchat in secret, even though Mom would have flipped if she found out. With each funny snap from Jake, each goofy face and silly meme, I felt like I was getting a peek into a world that had always been just out of reach. A world where I was free to be a regular teenage girl without worrying about Ruby's moods or the family vlogging business. It was understood that until I turned 18, I would have to get Ruby's approval for anything I posted on social media. This included Instagram and, for a while, YouTube. Snapchat was always expressly forbidden. The approval process was quite rigorous. I would text her pictures along with the proposed captions asking, "Is this okay to post?" Stories were the exception. She usually allowed me to post those without oversight. As I got older, I developed a better sense of what would be deemed acceptable, but Ruby's final approval was still required. When Ruby vetoed a post, it was usually selfies that could have been over-sexualized by others. Looking back, I understand. I think any good mother would have made similar choices. It wasn't about posting anything truly inappropriate. I would have never considered posting underwear pics, for instance. But I remember one time when I wanted to post a picture of myself attempting to do the splits in midair, with the caption joking about my lack of flexibility. Ruby said nope to that one. Whether it was about protecting me or preserving her wholesome online image, I'm not sure. A little of both, probably. The line between genuine parental concern and brand management was often blurry in our household. The hallways of our school soon became a hotbed of gossip, all centered around Jake's interest in me. As a result, the same popular girls who had eagerly welcomed me to their cafeteria table turned on me with startling speed. One minute I was their ticket to social media fame, the next I was a threat to their carefully maintained hierarchy. Their whispered comments echoed through the corridors. Why would Jake be with her? It was funny how quickly their fake friendship crumbled the moment I became competition rather than an asset. Things escalated when one of the meaner girls texted me an old photo of Jake kissing another girl, as if this piece of ancient history would somehow shatter my world. I couldn't help but laugh at the desperation of it all. Did they really think I would care about an outdated photo? These girls who had seemed so intimidating and powerful just a week ago now appeared small and immature. One sunny afternoon, I found myself settled under a sprawling oak tree with Jake, the grass tickling my bare legs, our knees almost touching as we talked and laughed. I can't believe it. We're finally hanging out, Jake said, his eyes crinkling at the corners as he smiled. A warm blush crept up my cheeks. As we chatted, I marveled at how easy it felt. Unlike the stilted, surface-level conversations I had with everyone else, with Jake, everything flowed naturally, as if we'd known each other for years. Suddenly, the air between us shifted. Jake leaned in, his eyes flicking down to my lips. Can I kiss you, Sherry? He asked, his voice barely above a whisper. My heart thundered in my chest. This is really happening. I nodded, wide-eyed, tilting my face up to meet his. You can close your eyes, Jake said gently. Oh, okay, I stammered, feeling my cheeks burn hotter. Our lips met, our noses bumping slightly, and a jolt of electricity raced through me. It was like 1,000 tiny fireworks exploding beneath my skin, from my lips all the way down to my toes. In that moment, the world around me faded away. There was no YouTube channel, no Ruby, no school drama, just me and Jake sharing our first kiss under an old oak tree. As I walked home later, I couldn't wipe the smile off my face. I wanted to etch every detail of this moment into my memory forever. I'd never felt so happy in my life. That feeling evaporated the moment I stepped through our front door. Ruby and Kevin sat on the living room couch, their faces set in rigid lines, eyes boring into me like lasers. Your mom and I need to talk to you, Kevin said, his tone grave. Panic surged through me. They must know about Jake. My mind raced, searching for an explanation, an excuse, anything. How dare you download Snapchat without telling us, hissed Ruby. Snapchat? That's what they're mad about? Thank goodness. Oh, I'm sorry, Mom, I mumbled. It's just everyone at school has it. Ruby's eyes flashed. I said no social media unless it's approved by me. I hung my head, guilt twisting my stomach. I didn't mean to. Didn't mean to what? Jeopardize everything we've worked for? Put our entire livelihood at risk? Her words were sharp, cutting. No, of course not. I just wanted to feel like a normal kid. Ruby's laugh was harsh, devoid of humor. Sherry, we're not normal. We're public figures. Every move we make, every word we say, directly impacts our income. Can you try to wrap your head around it? As she continued her tirade about the brand and the channel that puts food on the table, I noticed that not once did Ruby say she was worried for my safety. It was about control, about maintaining the perfect image for her precious audience. Hand over your phone, Ruby demanded coldly. Clearly, you're not mature enough to handle the responsibility of a smartphone. Never before had I felt such profound gratitude for Snapchat's vanishing messages and for having meticulously purged every text exchanged with Jake, leaving no digital footprint for Ruby to follow. She replaced my iPhone with an ancient flip phone in case I needed to make calls. She might as well have sent me to school in a horse and buggy, and I could practically hear the snickers of my classmates already. So, one evening, when my parents were out, I crept into their bedroom, my target clear, the iPhone imprisoned in Ruby's closet. She kept it locked away, but I had long ago discovered the hiding place of the key. That night, in the shadows of my bedroom, I scrolled through Jake's Snapchat stories again, stifling giggles at his goofy selfies. Each swipe of the screen was an act of defiance, a stolen moment of normalcy in my increasingly controlled world. The risk? Off the charts. If Ruby caught me, she would unleash a tempest. But the thrilling cocktail of autonomy and connection with my crush was too potent to resist. For in those moments, I finally tasted freedom. And even if Ruby found out and metaphorically skinned me alive, it still felt worth it. Chapter 12. I don't think my mother loves me. I sat at my desk, journal open before me, pen poised over a blank page. The house was quiet, the cameras were off, and for once, I had a moment truly to myself. As I stared at the empty page, a wave of clarity washed over me, bringing with it a realization that had been lurking just beneath the surface of my thoughts for years. The words seemed to write themselves, stark and undeniable, on the page. I don't think my mother loves me. A tear escaped, landing on the page with a soft splat, blurring the words, but the truth of the statement remained. I knew these words weren't stemming from just teenage angst. The sentiment felt very real and somehow insurmountable. Why didn't my mother love me, was the question. Had I done something to repel her, to drive her away? Did I not smile enough? Was I too sarcastic, too brainy, too self-absorbed? Did I accidentally roll my eyes at her jokes? I dissected a life's worth of interactions with Ruby, searching for clues, for some logical explanation as to why I felt so very disliked by the woman who gave birth to me. My mind drifted to the comments I'd read online about myself, words of strangers on YouTube who thought they knew me based on carefully edited snippets of my life. Ugh, Sherry is such a kiss-ass. She's always ratting out her siblings and trying to be Ruby's favorite. So smug. Was that why Ruby didn't love me? Because I came across as a suck-up goody-two-shoes? Even if it was, I wished that these strangers, who saw only what Ruby wanted them to see, could understand that my obedience was born not out of adoration, but fear. If only they knew the real me, I thought. The me who dreamed of a life far away from the circus. But no, all they saw was Ruby's obedient little puppet dancing on her strings. I thought back to all the times I had smiled and nodded along with Ruby's demands, even when every fiber of my being wanted to say no. The countless moments I had bitten my tongue, swallowing my true feelings and opinions for the sake of keeping the peace and ensuring the money kept rolling in. Our subscribers didn't understand what it was like to live under Ruby's iron fist. They didn't know the consequences of stepping out of line. I'm not sucking up, I'm surviving, I thought. There's a difference. But was that a reason for Ruby not to love me? I ping-ponged between trying to understand my mother's coldness toward me and the public comments tearing me down. The result was a new feeling, a sort of emptiness I'd never experienced before. I didn't understand what it was, not until one day, in my 8th grade year, I took a compulsory unit on mental health in school, and I learned about the symptoms of depression. There, I recognized myself. Hopelessness. Self-loathing. And sometimes a desire to just end it all. I never told anyone about those feelings before, but now that I knew they had a name, I felt compelled to say it out loud. Immediately after the class, I texted Kevin. Dad, I'm depressed. I don't know if I want to live anymore. Thank you for telling me, he wrote back immediately. We're going to get through this together. He even shared a link to an inspiring talk that he thought might help. Dad's quick response sent a wave of relief washing over me. For the first time in what felt like forever, I didn't feel so alone. Sure, an inspiring talk wasn't going to fix everything, but knowing that he was there, ready to listen and help, that was everything to me in that moment. But as I walked home from school, my relief curdled into dread. Dad would tell Ruby. Of course he would. They always shared everything, united in their parental front. The thought of facing her, of having to lay bare my depression under her scrutinizing gaze, made my stomach churn. I wasn't ready for that conversation. How could I be, when I knew, deep down, that a significant source of my sadness was her? When I got home, instead of going inside, I sat on a wall at the side of the house. For 3 long hours, I perched there, my mind a sea of thoughts, waiting for Kevin to get back from work. As soon as Kevin's car pulled into the driveway, he spotted me. Surprise flickered across his face as he approached. Sherry, why are you sitting out here? I shook my head, the words stuck in my throat, my feelings too tangled to express. Concern deepened the lines on his face. How are you feeling, sweetheart? I'm okay, I lied, forcing a weak smile. Kevin studied me for a moment, clearly not convinced. Sherry, would you like to talk to someone? Maybe try therapy? My heart leapt at the suggestion, a lifeline. Yes, I whispered, nodding emphatically. With a gentle hand on my shoulder, Kevin guided me inside. The conversation that followed went exactly as I had feared. Ruby listened, but never truly understood, her eyes glazing over with dismissal. Therapy? She scoffed, waving her hand. Don't be ridiculous. You just need to sleep better, exercise more, and eat right. But Kevin surprised me. No, he said firmly. We should let her see a therapist. This is serious, Ruby. Ruby's face flickered with shock, then hardened into stubborn resistance. But Kevin stood his ground, a quiet determination in his eyes that I'd rarely seen before. I retreated to my room, curling up on my bed, listening to my parents argue about my mental health. My pain was real, I knew that. And for once, it seemed, at least Kevin was seeing me, really seeing me. That small realization felt like hope, somehow. Journal. Today was Sunday, and Mom has been acting like a little shit all day. She yells because I randomly shut down and shut everyone out. I'm not the one causing your depression and anxiety, she yells. Well, hate to break it to you, Mom, but you are. You're the root of it all. But it's up to me to deal with it, and I do that by ignoring you. It's easier that way. No anxiety attacks, no getting worked up and angry. It's just better to shut down. I feel more at peace when I tune you out, when I retreat into my own world. It's not perfect, but at least it's away from you. After opening up to Kevin, I also started confiding in my bishop. Not about Ruby specifically, it felt too close to home, but about other things. I'd unpack the same details over and over, a broken record of unrelenting guilt and shame. It was like picking at a scab, never letting it heal, seeking absolution while punishing myself. "Bishop, I'm sorry to keep bothering you with this," I began, my voice barely above a whisper. "But I can't stop thinking about when I kissed Jake. I feel terrible. Was it too passionate? I keep replaying it over and over in my head. Did I break all my promises to God? Does this mean I'm a bad person?" I buried my face in my hands, waves of shame and remorse washing over me. "Sherry, we've talked about Jake before, remember? Quite a few times. And I'll tell you what I told you before. God knows your heart. You mustn't be so hard on yourself." "But," I began, my voice gaining strength, "I thought a good person examines her thoughts and actions every day to root out any sin or impurity. Isn't it our duty to always be vigilant, to never let ourselves become complacent? The moment we do is the moment we open the door for Satan to lead us astray." He sighed, removing his glasses to rub the bridge of his nose. I recognized that gesture. It was the same one he made every time I came to him, obsessing over the same perceived crimes, never satisfied with his absolution. "Sherry," he said gently, "I think it might be helpful for you to talk to a therapist about this." "My mom won't let me." It's okay to take care of your mental health. It's obvious your scrupulosity is causing you a lot of distress. Mom says all problems can be solved with prayer, diet, and exercise. Please ask her, Sherry. Remember, seeking professional help is nothing to be ashamed of. You don't have to go through this alone. I walked home, certain Ruby would say no. And what was that other thing you said? Scrupulosity? What even is that? The word felt foreign on my tongue. As soon as I got home, I turned on my computer and typed scrupulosity into the search bar. There it was, in black and white. The relentless cycle of guilt and self-flagellation that had become my constant companion. The endless loop of worry about every moral misstep, no matter how minor. The hypervigilance that turned every thought into a potential sin. The exhausting mental gymnastics of trying to be perfect. The crushing weight of guilt that seemed to follow me everywhere. Great, I thought. Not only am I depressed, now I'm suffering with religious OCD too. Why am I so broken? The websites I delved into painted a challenging picture of recovery. Breaking free from the chains of scrupulosity they warned was no easy feat. Unlearning patterns of hypervigilance and self-criticism etched deep into your neural pathways over years is a painstaking process. It's like trying to rewire your own brain's circuitry, one fragile connection at a time. I would need to become a vigilant guardian of my own mind, learn to catch toxic thoughts before they took root and spread like invasive weeds. Kevin and my bishop were right. I couldn't do this alone. I had to get therapy, and a lot of it, probably. I just hoped that Ruby would agree. Chapter 13. Busted. "Sherry, let me shape your brows," Ruby cooed one day, brandishing wax strips. She'd learned some cosmetology tricks from her sisters over the years and was always eager to test out her skills on me and my siblings. But this wasn't just about beauty, it was content, and content was currency. By this point, 8 Passengers had amassed nearly 1 million followers. That number wasn't just a statistic, it was a force that reshaped our entire existence. Each follower represented a fraction of a cent in ad revenue, a potential customer for sponsored content, a tiny piece of the puzzle that had transformed our family dynamics into a lucrative business model. The financial implications were impossible to ignore. Ruby and Kevin had traded in our old minivan for a gleaming Chevy behemoth, complete with an 8 Passengers license plate and an 8 Passengers sticker emblazoned on the back, a rolling billboard for our commodified family life. Sometimes, cruising down the freeway, we'd catch other drivers waving at us, their faces lighting up with recognition. We were famous influencers now, our everyday lives a source of entertainment for millions. I eyed the wax strip suspiciously. I couldn't help but wonder, was this a moment of possible mother-daughter bonding, or just another scene in our never-ending family sitcom? The line between genuine interaction and performance had blurred so completely that sometimes, I wasn't sure any of us could tell the difference anymore. "Come on, Sherry, it'll be a great video for the channel. I'll give you $100. "Okay, you can wax my brows," I said, plopping down in the chair she'd set up in the bright glare of the ring light. Ruby had a salesperson's gift of making everything seem like an adventure, and $100 in the name of beauty sounded just fine by me. The pain was nothing compared to the horror show I witnessed in the mirror afterward. Ruby had waxed off half my left eyebrow, leaving a sharp 90-degree angle that made me look like I was perpetually shocked by my own reflection. Who needs symmetry when you can rock the Spock meets surprise squirrel look? I was mortified, but of course Ruby kept the camera rolling, zooming in on my face like she was documenting a rare species of unibrowed teen in its natural habitat. The money shot, indeed. "Sherry, I'm so sorry," she exclaimed, her voice quivering with what I'm sure was remorse and definitely not barely contained glee at striking content gold. Sure enough, the video titled, "Sherry, I'm so sorry," with a thumbnail of me mid-ugly cry, racked up hundreds of thousands of views. Wonderful, I thought. I always wanted to be famous for my crazy eyebrows. I had to wear huge sunglasses for a few weeks to hide my mother's handiwork, and I don't recall ever seeing that $100 either. Jake and I barely crossed paths that week. If he noticed my half-missing eyebrow, he was kind enough to stay silent. Every moment with him felt stolen, precious, and slightly lopsided. Ruby would never allow it. We both knew that. Still, I savored our time together, my first romance, now with 50% less eyebrow. A few weeks later, I came home from school to find Ruby and Kevin waiting for me, looking like a pair of disappointed statues. "Sherry," Ruby began, her voice like frostbite, "we need to talk." I stood frozen in the doorway, my backpack a lead weight on my shoulders. "We're pulling you out of school," she announced, dropping the bomb. "At the end of the semester, you'll be transferring to Chad's school." "What?" I whispered, shock coursing through my veins. "But why?" "It's for the best, Sherry," she continued, her gaze unwavering. "We need to do a better job of protecting you." "Protecting me from what?" "Jake's mother called me yesterday." My stomach plummeted. "She said you've been hiding a laptop and communicating with him," Ruby continued, her voice taking on a razor's edge. "About how you've been spending time together. How long have you been hiding this, Sherry?" "Mom," I protested weakly, feeling the heat rise in my cheeks. "We're just friends. We barely even..." "Clearly," Ruby cut me off, her words sharp enough to draw blood. "The students at your junior high are a bad influence on you. This move isn't up for discussion, Sherry." I stared at the carpet, fighting back tears, and the sense that I was about to dramatically faint like a Victorian lady. "But I like my school," I whispered, hating how small and pathetic my voice sounded. "You'll like your new school better," Ruby declared. "The classes are much smaller, the teachers are excellent, and everyone there will be of our faith." Kevin chimed in here, finally remembering he was part of this parental tag team. "It will be a much safer environment for you, Sherry," he said softly. A familiar sense of powerlessness washed over me. Once again, my life was being reshaped without my consent, my choices stripped away, this time in the name of safety. I asked to be excused and fled to the bathroom, locking the door behind me with trembling hands. My chest constricted, each breath a labored struggle against an invisible weight. The crushing sensation was terrifying, like drowning on dry land. I knew this unwelcome visitor, a panic attack. I'd had them before, but never quite as bad as this. Unsure what to do, I shed my clothes and turned on the shower. I lay down in the tub, knees drawn to my chest, arms wrapped tightly around myself as if I could physically hold the fragments of myself together. Water cascaded over my body and face, my breaths coming in short gasps as I grappled with the suddenly complex task of inhaling and exhaling. In that moment, with the water drumming against the porcelain, that chilling thought came, "I want to die." The idea of not existing brought a perverse sense of relief, even as the rational part of my brain fought against it. The rational part of my brain fought back. "No, God wants you alive, Sherry. This must all be part of his plan. Gosh, though, there must be something deeply, fundamentally wrong with me for God's plan to hurt this much." "Worthless," another voice hissed in my head, a mean girl's whisper in a high school hallway. "You're an ungrateful daughter and a bad person. You deserve all of this. That's why this is happening to you. That's why God is making you suffer." I clamped my hands over my ears, attempting to block out the poison darts of my own thoughts. As the water ran cold and my teeth began to chatter, I uncurled myself slowly, feeling hollowed out, scoured clean of everything except a dull, throbbing ache. Standing on legs as wobbly as a newborn giraffe's, I caught a glimpse of myself in the mirror, pale, sad, exhausted. As I wrapped myself in a towel, a small, defiant part of me whispered, "God loves you, Sherry." It was a faint whisper, barely audible, but it was there. Chapter 14, Mommy's Little Drama Queen. After the shower panic attack, Kevin had finally been able to convince Ruby that I needed therapy. I'd been going once a week, and while I liked my therapist, Dr. Winters, I was always tiptoeing around the truth, terrified Ruby's name might slip out. What if it got back to her somehow? "How are you feeling today, Sherry?" she asked me as I sank into the oversized armchair, my fingers tracing invisible patterns on the armrest. "I'm okay, I guess." Dr. Winters leaned forward slightly. "Just okay?" Ruby's face flashed in my mind. I swallowed hard. "I've been having trouble sleeping," I admitted. "A safe start. Can you tell me more about that?" I stared at my hands. "It's like there's this weight on my chest, all the time." "And when did you first notice this weight?" "I don't know. A while ago, I guess." Dr. Winters nodded, jotting something down. "Sherry, remember what we talked about? This is a safe space." "Yeah, of course." Nonetheless, I painted around the edges of my pain, never quite touching its core. I spoke of anxiety, of sleepless nights, of feeling lost, but never of Ruby, never of the cameras, never of the pressure cooker that was our home. Dr. Winter's office, with its soothing earth tones and gentle light, should have been a haven. Yet for a long time, I found myself instinctively erecting walls around myself every time I was there. Little by little, though, I began to unfurl. Words I never dared speak out loud started to bubble up. "Sometimes I see cars driving by, and I think about what if I just stepped in front of it," I confessed. "Do you feel like you can talk to your family about these feelings?" she asked softly. I laughed, a bitter sound that surprised even me. "No, not really." "Why is that?" I froze, Ruby's face again looming in my mind. I shook my head. "I just can't." One session stands out clearly in my memory. I finally worked up the courage to tell Dr. Winters something that had been weighing on me for years. "I really don't like piano," I admitted, my voice barely above a whisper. "Mom's been making me play piano since I was 5, and practicing with her is actually a huge source of stress for me." With my consent, the therapist invited Ruby, who was waiting outside, into our session. "Sherry, can you tell your mom what you just told me?" she prompted gently. I took a deep breath, avoiding Ruby's eyes. "I don't want to take piano lessons anymore," I said, bracing myself for the backlash. Instead, Ruby just said, "Okay, Sherry, you don't have to play piano, and we never have to talk about it again." A strange mixture of relief and unease washed over me. I'd won a huge victory, but Ruby's easy acquiescence felt oddly hollow. We drove home without a word, and I went straight to my room, which I shared with my youngest sister. She started coming into my room of her own accord and asking to sleep with me, which I thought was so cute. Now it had become a habit, and I didn't mind, even though it meant I had to be super quiet going to bed because of our different bedtimes. We shared my giant king-size bed, me on one side and her on the other, and oftentimes I'd read to her at night to help her fall asleep. But honestly, I may have needed her more than she needed me. She was my sleeping pill, my lullaby cherub. With her next to me, I always felt safer at night somehow, as if something about her could keep the demons at bay. Usually she was in bed long before me, but that night she was the one who tucked me in as I crawled under the sheets. I was grateful for her presence, this tiny guardian angel who could make even the darkest nights feel a little less lonely. Journal. I'm shutting down more and more often. I can't help it, even though my silence really triggers Mom. She seems to think if I'm quiet that I have a bad attitude. The truth is, I'm quiet because I irrevocably and undeniably hate myself, and I have for a while. She doesn't know I cried on my bed for an hour today. That I'm full of disgust when I look in the mirror, that I'm trying so hard to hold on. I just have to remember, my last day won't be my worst. I pasted on a happy smile for the camera as Ruby announced my transfer to my new school to her 8 passengers viewers. Chad, standing beside me, was visibly less than thrilled that his big sister would be joining him at his school. I could practically feel the waves of resentment radiating off him at the prospect of me invading his turf. He had by then perfected the art of the passive-aggressive eye roll, and he employed it now with expert precision. Determined to make the best of this fresh start, even as my heart ached with familiar comfort of my old school, I decided on a coping strategy. I would throw myself into my studies, lose myself in the pages of great books, and find solace in the realm of ideas. It was a defense mechanism, a way to build walls around my heart with knowledge and academic achievement. "What class you got first?" Chad, now 12, asked me as we navigated the crowded halls to our classes. "English," I replied. We're starting Lord of the Rings today. A flicker of interest sparked in Chad's eyes before he quickly smothered it with a smirk. Nerd, he scoffed, but there was no real bite to it. We were so different on the surface. While I was laser-focused on my studies, Chad, the budding athlete, was making his name on the football field, setting numerous records for the 100-meter dash. The possibility of sports scholarships loomed large in his future, pretty much the opposite of his bookish, introspective older sister, grappling with depression. Yet a connection had always hummed between us, a shared understanding of our absurd circumstances that went beyond words. Chad's gaze snagged on a group of athletes roughhousing by the water fountain, their raucous laughter echoing off the cinderblock walls. Chad and his friends were all class clowns, the kind of kids who'd run down the hallways and exaggerate in Naruto runs, an anime-inspired style of running with arms stretched behind them as if they were being pursued by the ghosts of their GPAs. I always found myself torn between embarrassment and a grudging admiration for Chad's ability to be so carefree. "Catch you later, sis," he said, directing a casual wave at his friends before vanishing into the throng of bodies. I watched him go, a half-smile tugging at my lips. "Catch you on the flip side, Chad. Don't let the jockstraps hit you on the way out." I shouldered my way into the English classroom, sinking into my seat just as the bell rang. As our teacher passed out battered copies of the Fellowship of the Ring, I felt a thrill of anticipation zipping down my spine. I had seen the movies but never read the books, and there was something about Tolkien's world that had always called to me, even as a child. Poring over the pages in the classroom, I felt a spark of excitement for the first time in ages. The world Tolkien had created, with its intricate interplay of good and evil, spoke to me on a deep level. Mostly, though, there was something oddly calming about escaping into a world where even the smallest, most unassuming creatures could change the course of history. In the lesson, we debated which characters could be read as Christ figures, how the hobbits represented the purity of childhood, embodying the love for simple joys of nature, play, food, and companionship, and how it was their inherent goodness that allowed them to carry the ring without being immediately corrupted. I especially loved Sam, that sweet, hobbity cinnamon roll, that loyal little potato, too good, too pure for this world. I wished I could have had a friend like him. "So, Sherry," our teacher said, his keen gaze settling on me, "what do you believe the ring symbolizes at its core?" "I think," I began, my voice quavering before finding its strength, "I think it symbolizes the duality within us all, our capacity for great good and great evil." "That's good, Sherry. Could you elaborate?" The classroom fell silent, every eye trained on me, the new girl. The words poured out of me in a rush. "It's like the ring is inherently neutral, you know? It's what we choose to do with it that matters." I paused, my heart hammering against my ribcage. "Look at how the ring corrupts Gollum. I think it's a warning. Tolkien reminding us never to let our selfishness consume us until we lose sight of what really matters." Even as I spoke, an image of Ruby flashed through my mind. The way social media had her in its thrall. The lens of her iPhone camera seeing everything, like Sauron, the giant, flaming eyeball of doom. My teacher nodded, his brow furrowed in thought. "So, Sherry, if the ring represents our capacity for evil, for destruction of self and others, what is its opposite?" "Love," I said, the word carrying more weight than I intended. "Kindness, the kind of bond that Sam and Frodo share, that endures through all hardship. The kind of love I yearned for, but rarely felt at home." I stared down at my book, cheeks flushed. I felt exposed, as if I'd revealed too much. But when I looked up, the teacher was smiling. "Yes, Sherry, I think Tolkien himself would appreciate that interpretation," he said. As soon as classes ended that day, I rushed home. My weekly therapy session with Dr. Winters was that evening, and I desperately wanted to eat some dinner beforehand. I always found it difficult to bear my soul on an empty stomach. I was halfway through a bowl of hastily prepared pasta in the kitchen when Ruby appeared, her footsteps soft on the linoleum. She sat down next to me, a strange smile playing at the corners of her mouth. "What is it, Mom?" I asked, my fork hovering midair. "Great news, sweetheart," Ruby chirped, her voice syrupy sweet. "I had a chat with Dr. Winters today, and she thinks you're just fine. She doesn't want to waste our money on unnecessary sessions. So you don't need to eat so fast. No therapy today." I swallowed hard, trying to process her words. "Mom," I ventured, my voice barely above a whisper, "she really thinks I'm fine?" It wasn't that long ago that I had shared my thoughts of suicide with her. "Yes," Ruby said, her eyes bright with an emotion I couldn't quite place. "You're fine. You're not around Jake. You don't have a smartphone. You're good." Is this because I quit Piano Mom? Are you mad about how that happened? Is that why I can't do therapy anymore? Not at all. No more therapy. Doctor's orders. It didn't make sense to me. I needed more time. I was making progress, inching towards something that felt like healing. Mom, I'd like to carry on if I can, I said, pushing my bowl away. Ruby's smile faltered for a moment. Listen to me, Sherry. The doctor thinks you're a very well-adjusted girl with, how do I put it, an active imagination. Wait, she thinks I'm making this up? Mommy's little drama queen is looking for attention, Ruby said, reaching out to ruffle my hair. I flinched, but she didn't seem to notice. I didn't believe her. There was no way my therapist, the one person I thought I could trust, could have told my mother I was fabricating my struggles. But whether Ruby was lying or my therapist had betrayed me, the result was the same. My little therapy experiment was over. In this family, the only safe emotion was no emotion at all. Chapter 15. 1 million followers. That same month I started my new school, September 2017, Ruby hit a huge milestone. Her subscriber base had reached 1 million, 2.5 years after launching her channel. I remember the day well because I happened to be sick in bed, fighting what felt like either mono or strep, when Ruby's familiar vlog voice drifted through my closed door. Sherry, honey, she called out, her tone saccharine sweet. Are you throwing up? Does your gut hurt like you're nauseated? Yes, I groaned, my throat feeling like I'd swallowed broken glass. I knew she was filming this. I could tell by her tone. Forget chicken soup and a cold compress, Mom, I thought. What I really need is a camera rolling while I'm puking my guts out in a bucket. I heard Ruby continue to cheerfully address her viewers, her voice filled with excitement. Good morning, passengers. Today's exciting. Crazy day. Number one, we're counting down to 1 million. Number two, Sherry doesn't feel good. I'm going to get her into a doctor to see if she has strep. Later that day, she filmed herself while running errands, her eyes darting between the road and her phone as our subscriber count climbed steadily toward the big number, 998,000, 999,000. When the counter hit 1 million, she pulled over, filled with emotion, and triumphantly addressed her viewers. It's perfect. Hitting this milestone while doing the little things, that's what makes mothers powerful. In her mind, buying Chad's cheese, mailing my package, driving me to the doctor, these were her superpowers, the everyday acts that built her empire, 1 million subscribers earned between errands. The video cut to me at urgent care. Visibly weak and exhausted, I tried to smile for the camera. Years of conditioning had taught me to always be pleasant, always be amiable for Ruby, no matter how crappy I felt. At that point, I think I was running a temperature of 102. But for once, smiles weren't what Ruby wanted. You can't smile while you're in the Instacare, Sherry, Ruby chided, her voice a mixture of playfulness and command. You're supposed to look like you're on your deathbed. I complied instantly, feigning death with a touch of theatricality that I knew would please her. Whatever she wanted. Oh, and I didn't have strep. I had mono, the kissing disease. Not that I'd been doing much kissing, to be honest. Not at all, in fact, even though I was in a kind of romance. With a kid called Mark, a boy I had met just before switching schools. Her relationship, if you could call it that, was a study in adolescent awkwardness and the complexities of growing up in the public eye. Mark and I started liking each other in 8th grade, right after things fizzled out with Jake. Something about kissing Jake, it was as if a switch had been flipped. I went from never having made out with someone to suddenly realizing, oh my gosh, this is really fun. This period was marked by what I'd call moments of non-committal makeouts. It wasn't about deep emotional connections or starting new relationships. Instead, it was a time of exploration and discovery, both of myself and of this new world of kissing that had previously been off limits. It was fun, discovering that boys don't taste like frogs after all. I found myself kissing about 4 or 5 boys during this time, a sort of kissing spree, which, for someone who had grown up in such a restrictive environment, felt revelatory. A small act of rebellion against the rigid rules that had governed my life for so long. The LDS Church teaches that our physical bodies are gifts from God to be treated with respect and gratitude, and has long-held chastity as a core tenet of its faith, with the overarching principle being that sexual relations should only occur between a married man and woman. We weren't ever supposed to lie on top of someone who wasn't our spouse, and we were urged to avoid passionate kissing before marriage. Oops. After a while, though, I noticed the disconnect between physical and emotional intimacy. These encounters were fun and exciting, but they lacked the deeper emotional connection I had experienced with Jake. And that was what I really longed for. I wanted someone who I really liked in a deeper way. Someone who wasn't just interested in kissing. You know, a real connection, like when you both reach for the last slice of pizza at the same time. That's where Mark came into the picture. I liked Mark a lot, and he wasn't interested in kissing me at all, which helped assuage my guilt surrounding my little kissing spree. Mark and I would go on dates all the time, even though we never went so far as to say we were dating. And to call him my boyfriend would be a stretch. He never held my hand and was quite uncomfortable with hugging, let alone a kiss. It was more of a weird friendship than a romance. And we were like two awkward penguins waddling side by side, occasionally bumping into each other, but never quite figuring out how to huddle for warmth. Of course, that didn't stop Ruby from capitalizing on the situation for views. Sherry's crush or Sherry's boyfriend made for clickbait titles, even if it didn't align with reality or our family's rule about not having boyfriends until at least 16. Either way, our platonic teenage romance was pretty cute looking back on it. Like this huge buildup, destined for nowhere, a rom-com that forgot the rom and doubled down on the com. In our family, skiing was always the winter sport of choice. Chad hit the slopes regularly during the winter months, carving through fresh powder with the ease of someone born with skis on their feet. Kevin, having grown up with the sport, was equally at home on the mountainside. But me, I wanted to be different.